Welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Amy Stulick, reporter with Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined for this episode by Rick Matros, CEO of Saber Healthcare Real Estate Investment Trust. Matros, who has served as CEO for Saber since May 2010, discussed the challenges in skilled nursing financing, why Medicaid rates are expected to remain high through 2025, and the REIT's focus on innovative providers along with tech pilots to enhance operations. Before we get to that conversation, I'd like to highlight an upcoming event in the new year. Skilled Nursing News 2025 Clinical Executive Conference will take place on February 18th in Bonita Springs, Florida. Clinical explores trends, challenges, and opportunities facing clinical and business leaders in skilled nursing. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to find out more. And now, my conversation with Rick Matros. Well, thank you, Rick, so much for joining us. So, of course, I have some financing questions for you first. Let's talk about financing in the skilled nursing space. What challenges have you seen to financing in the industry, and what might be expected for the new year?
So generally, financing just hasn't come back very much for skilled nursing. It's come back a lot more for senior housing, although it's still hurting there, but there's just not much available on skilled nursing financing. There is HUD availability, but HUD at its best is extremely slow, and it's even slower now. So you combine the slowness with the fact that understandably they're also going to be a lot more selective given how many operators are still recovering from the pandemic. And it just leaves operators who need financing in a tough spot outside of the REITs, obviously.
Right. And then how might the federal staffing mandate affect financing for the skilled nursing sector? Do you think that they're less likely to lend considering regulations coming down and the staffing shortage? And, you know, can stiffer regulations on staffing impact lending in the space?
Well, I don't think the staffing mandate is going to happen, so I think it's a non-issue. We've got the lawsuit that probably gets heard in January. The Chevron issue should make it even easier to beat it, although we thought we had all the facts on our side to begin with. And then we've also got a legislative path as well. So I don't expect that to happen at all. And I've been saying that for over a year now. And even if it were, you know, you've got a couple of years before it even happens. And then there's a phase-in period over a longer period of time. And look, the operators, even with the staffing shortage, the operators that I think have the highest acuity and engage in other kinds of programs will be better off. I think the operators that would get hurt are the more traditional, you know, mom-and-pop kind of Medicaid shop, traditional long-term care operators. So I think, but they're not on the right path. If that's your strategy is to stay a traditional long-term care provider, you're probably not going to make it in the long run anyway, regardless of the staffing mandate or anything else. And outside of the staffing mandate, we just don't see anything, happening that's going to cause a problem, from a lending perspective or really any perspective. In fact, I think just the opposite. I think the industry has a runway ahead of it that it hasn't had for a very long time, positively.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've said on earnings calls that Medicaid rates are a positive sign for nursing homes. And do you expect this trend to continue? And how will you mitigate it if rates are rolled back?
So I think they've pretty much done their job in most states, not all states, obviously, but one of the silver linings of the pandemic, there weren't very many, obviously, but one of them was that the industry who for years, and obviously it's state specific because it's Medicaid, has been talking about the underfunding of Medicaid. That became apparent to states during the pandemic when operators were just closing their doors. I'm sure you know, a lot of states really stepped up with FMAP. Some of them made it permanent. And now you've got inflation from 2021, 2022, that are catching up with the state formulas for Medicaid. So it's increased rates dramatically. So my expectation is we probably have one more year of outsized Medicaid rates. I don't think they're going to be as high next summer. I mean, July and August is when most of them come in for us. Over 70% of the rate increases happen in July and August. So it's not going to be for us, it was 7.1% this year for our entire portfolio. So I don't think it's going to be that high, but it's still going to be high. And then I think in 2026, it'll start coming back down. But I don't think it's going to be, even if it goes back to sort of the 1.5 to 2% averages that we saw for a really long time, I don't think it's going to be problematic at the time that it gets down there, because the combination of the demographic, which has already hit the industry, and the declining supply, the declining supply has gotten a lot of attention over the course of the pandemic because something like 800 buildings closed, but it's been declining for over 20 years. We have 1/3 the inventory today that we had 20 years ago. So that's just going to continue. And there's no building. There were, I think, 15 nursing homes in the entire country built last year. It's just nothing. So facilities are going to be effectively fully occupied. And that hasn't happened since before RUGS 4. So I think given the operating leverage in these facilities, you know, once you hit a certain occupancy point, you know, your margins continue to improve because the cost associated with additional patients starts to decrease. I think the industry is going to be just fine. In fact, maybe in better shape than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. And I have a couple of Sabra specific questions for you. We know that last February, Sabra sold a sizable skilled nursing facility portfolio at $200,000 per bed, almost double the national average, and other deals since. And if there's anything that you'd like to say about future investments or divestitures looking toward 2025.
Sure. So part of the reason that happened is over the last couple of years, there's several groups of private buyers out there that are operators, and they've been looking to grow portfolios. So a strategic buyer can pay more for a facility than an operator, than a REIT can, because we're just buying the real estate. And so what these folks what appeared to be paying up, because they also have a lot of ancillary businesses. So for them, the value of the deal wasn't just in the value of the facility itself or the operations of the facility, but the revenue that that facility would generate for their other businesses. So so not only Sabra, but some of our peers as well were able to get some pretty incredible prices for the portfolios that we sold. For us, we're pretty much done with all that. It'll be ordinary course of business. We have a couple of things that aren't nearly that big that we're working on, but not much left. And after that, it'll be kind of what you've seen historically when everything was more normalized, which is, you know, every once in a while you prune a facility or two here and there. We're working with a couple of our operators just to prune a couple of buildings here and there so that they weren't able to turn around through the pandemic, but nothing material.
Got it. And how have occupancy rates and contract labor fared in 2024? I know that Talia mentioned potential occupancy growth in the last earnings call for you folks. So any trends that you're seeing here across the sector?
Yeah, so occupancy just continues to grow. It's just not stopping. The rate of growth is still somewhat hampered by nursing shortages. You can only admit as many folks as you can take really good care of. So, but nevertheless, it's increasing all the time. And we're pretty, in the aggregate for the Sabra portfolio, we are pretty close to pre-pandemic occupancies. So we'll be exceeding pre-pandemic occupancies, you know, over the next year, and then it'll continue to grow after that. And between the outsized Medicaid and Medicare rates, our revenue per patient day has been stronger than the impact of labor inflation. So from a margin perspective, the business is actually ahead of where it was right before the pandemic. In the aggregate, obviously we have, you know, operators that are kind of all over the place because we have so many tenants, but in the aggregate. So, you know, I just think those trends are going to continue in terms of agency and labor. Generally, our labor has dropped dramatically. I mean, our agency is lower than it's been in 3.5 years. So it's still higher than it was pre-pandemic, but it's really dropped dramatically. And labor has moderated as well. In 2022, that was the year that our operators really rebased their wages and gave really tremendous increases to try to retain people and attract people into the space and to get people that were burned out back into the space. And we saw in 2023 and also in 2024 that was really effective, so that the wage inflation in 2023 and 2024 is more somewhere around mid-single digit as opposed to a healthy double digit that it needed to be in 2022 to be more competitive and be more attractive.
And then is there anything that you want to mention about growth projections in the next 5 to 10 years or plans to diversify in response to market changes?
So not really growth projections, although we have publicly said that, this year our year-over-year growth at the midpoint of our guidance is mid-single digit. And we think that's a reasonable assumption going forward, as far as we can see. In terms of where we're going to make our investments, it's primarily going to be in senior housing SHOP and in skilled nursing. So I think what you'll see is we're also in the behavioral space, as you probably know, and right, have been focusing on addiction treatment. But that's a very, very young, very fragmented space with not very many tried and true operators. So our growth there is going to be very careful and very incremental. So today, that the behavioral space is about 13%+ of our NOI. You're going to see that drop because most of our investing is going to be in skilled and senior housing. And so skilled is right now about half of our NOI, which is actually lower than it's ever been. So we're a more diversified REIT than we ever were. And I would expect us to stay, even with a lot of investing, somewhere around there. So for example, it's just because of our size. If we did $100 million in new investments in skilled nursing tomorrow, it would increase our exposure by less than 1 point, right? So so I think what you'll see is our skilled nursing asset base be somewhere around where it is now, give or take, and our senior housing SHOP will grow, which will push the behavioral down.
And it's really interesting to hear about the behavioral space as well, because I know that you folks were interested to potentially grow in that area. So interesting to hear how fragmented the space is. And it sounds like it's still kind of maybe more in its infancy, needs to evolve a little bit more.
Yeah. Oh, it's where senior housing was before 2000. I mean, it's that young. I mean, it's just now that we're beginning to understand that addiction really should be treated as a disease. Insurers have come around with the operators that we have. Most of the reimbursement is through insurance. Medicaid is still not there, except in a handful of states, so that'll improve over the years. But from a policy perspective and just a social perspective, we're just now as a society getting to the point where we're treating it the right way. And even still, we're only focused on adults, right? And we have a crisis in the country with mental health for our kids. And we're still at a place where society just doesn't like to acknowledge. It doesn't seem to want to acknowledge that a 9-year-old kid could have mental health issues. And so if you think about the long term, it's even as supply gets better, because right now there just isn't even close to enough supply to accommodate the need. But it's going to get worse, because if you don't start addressing it when people are at their youngest, then they're just going to be adults with bigger problems. Yeah. It's really terrible. It's really terrible, terrible problem. So I mean, I could talk about that one for a long time because I'm involved with it outside of Sabra as well. So,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's something to keep an eye on for the skilled nursing space as well. And, you know, I guess we'll see how it evolves, right? Like you said. But, you know, in terms of operators, I've been hearing a lot from skilled nursing operators about technology and innovation that, you know, they're trying to really incorporate that a lot more, especially considering the staffing shortages, you know, other challenges that they're facing. So I'm curious how Sabra plans to leverage technology and innovation with its assets.
Yeah, so we already have been. It's a huge initiative on our part to work with our operators. So the challenge is there's a gazillion different products out there. And so if you look at falls, for example, there's lots of different technologies to address falls. And as soon as you put one in today, it evolves 6 months from now, and you've got to look at things differently. So the approach that we've taken is, one, at our operators conference, we did a lot of best practices and shared with what our operators are doing. But we also put a fund in place to help operators access capital cheaply. And actually, they can access the capital and not even worry about paying us back until they get a return on their investment. So I think that's been helpful for our skilled providers to some extent. But the primary thing that we're doing is introducing pilot programs with different kinds of technologies to our operators so we can try different things. Because there's so much out there and you've got some percentage of those products that are going to get rolled up into other products. You've got some percentage of those products or those technologies that are just going to go out of business, right? Just because there's so much competition. So we've already done over 60 different pilots with different technologies. And some of those technologies are ESG related. And some of those technologies are not ESG related and some have overlap. So it's everything from, you know, from addressing the issues with falls to smart labor management to better lighting and air circulation systems to monitoring vitals remotely. You know, so all this kinds of stuff. So over some time, our hope then is that with all these pilots that we're doing, that we'll be able to ascertain which have been the most effective for our operators and then share with all of our operators which products work better than other products for whatever modality, you know, we're talking about. So we've been super, super active in it. We've got resources dedicated just to that within the REIT. And because it's critical for us to help our operators get to another level from a technological perspective, because healthcare has been so far behind other spaces, you know, historically with technology, and long-term care even more so.
Right. Yeah, that's very cool to hear. Curious to see how that evolves for you guys with the pilot programs.
Me too.
Yeah. And how is Sabra planning for sustainability? You know, there, of course, there's concerns around access as reimbursement and workforce issues, force closures and consolidation, depending on the state, not to mention access issues tied to the staffing mandate.
So, you know, we're focused on operators, one, that are both progressive and innovative in terms of going for the highest acuity possible so that you really become step-down units for acute hospitals, where we work with our operators that actively engage with I-SNPs, with insurers for bundled payments, value-based plans, things like that. So I think that's always been our focus. So none of the operators in our portfolio are sort of the traditional, you know, Medicaid long-term care providers. So I think from that perspective, we're going to be in really good shape for the long haul. In terms of the access issues, I think it's not that difficult to project where the declines are happening. We already know a number of markets out there, as I'm sure you do, that have access issues. And that's just going to get worse and worse and worse. There's no solution to it. There's no effort on the part of the federal government or the state government to address it. It's being completely ignored. And it's going to be a crisis throughout the country and over the next number of years. And again, there's no resolution in sight for it. So for the businesses that are innovative and necessary and are in the right markets, they're going to do great because they're going to be full all the time, or effectively full, right? So, right. So that's been our focus. And I think the pandemic helped sort of bring that focus, make that focus even sharper, because, you know, before the pandemic, I mean, it was always easy to identify weak operators from strong operators, but there were always sort of this group of operators that were, you know, pretty good operators, and they really cared about providing good patient care and all that sort of stuff, but they also weren't particularly innovative. You know, they just sort of went day to day, did a nice job taking care of folks and had good environments, and the pandemic was too much. So I think the pandemic also taught us that there really is a difference, not just between the strong operators and the weaker operators, but sort of that group in the middle, and that innovation is incredibly important in order for operators to thrive. Whether that, again, whether innovation is, it's really a combination of everything. It's a combination of everything we've talked about, technology and getting into I-SNPs and doing more with the insurers on value-based programs and all that.
Mm-hmm. And then I have a couple staffing and litigation questions for you. We kind of touched on this already, but you know, we may see some sort of resolution regarding the federal staffing mandate and lawsuits potentially by January. And you know, any additional commentary on how you expect things to play out here?
No, but I think that, well, one, yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I think we'll win on it. But I also think Chevron has other implications as it pertains to CMS. You know, one of the obvious ones is how many things they do sort of arbitrarily, like they'll decide tomorrow that they're just going to increase civil monetary penalties. I think Chevron's going to make it a lot more difficult for them to just do sort of whatever they want, whenever they want. And it's going to give the industry a stronger basis for fighting that. And I think knowing the American Healthcare Association as well as I do, and Cliff Porter, who's the new CEO, is on our board. They're going to be on top of it, and they're going to be aggressive about it to protect the industry. So I think all of that's really going to be helpful for those that, especially when you think about investors who get a little spooked by the complexity of the reimbursement system and 50-state Medicaid systems and what's going to happen with regulations, you know, tomorrow or next year or whatever. I think this helps.
Right. And you've definitely, you know, dipped into this a little bit as well. You know, of course, we know the SCOTUS decisions to roll back Chevron and allow companies to easily challenge civil monetary penalties in court have tipped the scales in favor of industries, it looks like. And any commentary other than what you've said already on how this will affect the skilled nursing industry moving ahead?
No, I think not more than I said, but I would also say, kind of in support of CMS, is that the relationship between the industry and CMS has improved a lot, and PDPM was sort of the best example of that. We had this really horribly designed system in RUGs, and when they went about going to put a new system in place, they actually engaged the industry as a partner in the technical groups they had to help develop the system. And I think that partnership had a really great result, because PDPM is really the best and most balanced reimbursement system on the Medicare side that the industry has ever had, and I think has achieved the goals that CMS was looking for as well. So, you know, I don't want to come across, you know, just a sort of negative CMS, but they do things arbitrarily as well. But there has been an effort there to improve the relationship with the industry, and I'm hopeful that they fully understand the ramifications of Chevron and what the industry's intentions would be to protect itself, and hopefully it won't get down to a bunch of fights over stuff.
And if it even happens, how has Sabra been preparing for the federal staffing mandate with its tenants?
Yeah, so it's hard to prepare for something that may not occur for a couple of years and then gets phased in, depending on rural and urban, over another 2 to 5 years. But because our focus has always been on the highest acuity operators, in the aggregate, our staffing is already higher than the minimum staffing requirement. Now, if you break it down by operator, you know, we have some operators that are well above and others that are falling below. But in the aggregate, the portfolio is already there. So I think as long as we continue to try to provide the support that we've been doing, that will help them sort of be a little bit more cutting edge in their communities with, you know, as I had already mentioned, some of the initiatives we have on the technological side. And even making introductions for things like iSNPs, because we have operators that are very active with iSNPs, and so we connect them with other operators who don't understand it yet and things like that. So I think really that's the best way to prepare. And plus, the other thing I would say is I think the industry, the operators learn some lessons from what happened during the pandemic with staffing in terms of taking too many things for granted. And we're seeing a lot of changes at the operator level in terms of culture with employees, in terms of how they recruit and how they onboard, and pairing people, you know, with buddies and mentors, with allowing more training after they get hired, before they get put on the floor. Things that, frankly, we used to do all the time. And I think we just sort of started taking it for granted. So I think all those things are really going to help. And we certainly, like with other things I've mentioned, we always look at best practices. So our asset management team, who, by the way, are all ex-operators, if you can be an ex-operator. and so they're constantly, when they see good things and good initiatives happening with one of our operators, they share that with other operators. So I think that's really the best way to prepare.
Mm-hmm. And then sticking with that, we've seen finance leaders for skilled nursing really get involved in staffing initiatives. You know, I'm thinking of Dwyer Workforce Development in particular. What kind of role do you think finance leaders should play in building the skilled nursing workforce?
So, well, one, I should say, I appreciate anything they do. I think whatever they do, it'll help more on the margin and with those operators specifically that they're doing business with. I think what we really need to have happen to make a difference are a couple of things. We need workforce initiatives that get legislatively passed at the national level, which that stuff is starting to happen. And certainly AHCA is very involved in trying to develop that and get sponsors for it and co-sponsors from Congress. In order for it really to impact the industry, I think things have to happen at a federal level. And then the other thing that needs to happen is there needs to be immigration reform, you know, for skilled workers. And while it's hard to imagine in this environment in DC that we'll ever get sort of full-blown immigration reform, we should be able to get sort of narrow reform that helps those industries that need skilled workers from other countries. And so that's a priority, I know, for the industry with the Hill as well.
Absolutely. And a couple forward-looking questions for you to wrap up. This podcast is called the Rethink Podcast. What should leaders and government agencies, along with the public, rethink about the skilled nursing sector?
Well, in terms of leadership at the public level, they need to start thinking about what they're going to do to address the access crisis that's already started happening, and which involves so many different things and so many levels, right? From CONs to just the cost of building a skilled nursing facility, because the industry is so regulated and there are so many hurdles. What wasn't that long ago, there was a new skilled nursing facility that was built in California. It took 4 years to get through all the regulatory hurdles to get it built. A facility in Texas, it was about 25% of the time because they have less regulatory hurdles there. So all that needs to be thought about much differently from both a federal and a state level. And frankly, I just don't see it happening, but that's what has to happen. And at the operator level, it's really just most of the stuff that we've already talked about. You know, look outside your four walls and what are the opportunities out there with insurers, with healthcare systems, with ISNPs, all those kinds of things. We're not just a straightforward Medicaid and Medicare business any longer. We've got to look to partnerships and, you know, what can you do to be more innovative, to make your facilities more welcoming. We have one operator that when you walk into the lobby, they put together a partnership with Starbucks. So everybody that walks in there can get a Starbucks, you know, the families. It's free for all the employees. That's like a really small thing, but it's actually a pretty cool thing, right? And it changes kind of the ambiance when you walk into a facility. So I think all those things... that, you know, taking advantage of the opportunities that are out there, that I think we would have already been a long way into doing, but the pandemic, you know, obviously created this crisis where everybody was just trying to survive day to day. So a number of the initiatives that you and I have discussed today, we actually were starting before the pandemic, and now it's getting back to all of them. It's sort of like you've had this really long four-year pause where... You really had to be careful about introducing too many things to your operators because they were just trying to survive.
Exactly.
So now it's really getting back to that and getting back to a lot of the things that we wanted to do at the end of 2019.
Absolutely. And what are you most excited to see from the skilled nursing industry in the years ahead as the sector continues to evolve?
So a couple of things. One, I'm excited that we're going to have an industry that's going to be effectively full, because that's going to put margins at a place where operators are actually going to have excess cash to reinvest in their business, which is always going to result in better outcomes for the folks that they take care of. So, you know, that's particularly exciting to me. And the other thing I'm looking forward to is, and who knows how much longer it'll take, it's been talked about for a long time, but CMS's intention from a reimbursement perspective all along has been to get to a neutral site payment system. And I am really looking forward to that. A neutral site payment system will be advantageous to the skilled nursing sector. When you look at IRFs, there's essentially no difference in outcomes between IRFs and skilled nursing facilities, but they get reimbursed way more. And the same with LTACs. LTACs are closing every day. There aren't that many left. There's got to be a reimbursement solution for folks that stay in LTACs that can get cared for in skilled nursing facilities. And I think neutral site is a way to get there. So I think it'll be a much simpler reimbursement system. We'll all be treated the same based on who we take care of. And I think that's advantageous for the industry.
Mm-hmm. And one last question before I let you go. I know you mentioned HUD at the beginning of our conversation. I'm really curious if you think that HUD will expand their program to incentivize improvements in quality and care models for nursing homes. You know, I know that Moving Forward Coalition was pushing for this, and, you know, HUD lending was rising at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I don't have that expectation. It's a program that moves at a snail's pace. We call it the most expensive cheap capital you can get. Because it's so difficult to manage and the administrative hurdles are just terrible. To me, they are the epitome of sort of the government bureaucracy. They just can't get out of their own way. So it'd be nice to think about, but I have zero expectation. And if I'm wrong, then I can be happily surprised, and that's great.
All right, Rick, thank you so much for your time and for your insights here.
You're welcome. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners about our upcoming clinical executive conference on February 18th in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to learn more and get tickets. Until next time, thanks for listening.